This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Matt Busby is director of the Camp House and pastor of cultural engagement for the Mission Chattanooga. In a podcast this month, he talked about systemic racism and Chattanooga's own history. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us more about this episode of the Camp House podcast.
Man, I don't think I can separate the episode that I created from so much of the learning that I've done both at the Camp House, you know, working with people in our community, as well as a lot of the hard work we've done within the Mission Chattanooga as part of our pastoral staff. I think the conversation around racial injustice and inequities and systemic racism is one that since Ferguson and since so many of the deaths of Black men at the hands of police and, you know, essentially white vigilantes for the past 3 or 4 years has really brought that conversation to the forefront within our own church and specifically among our pastoral staff. But also, you know, within the Camp House, you know, we've sought to use our resources and our stage to really give a voice to anybody who has something to contribute to the culture of our city. And through that, you know, I've made incredible relationships with Shane Morrow, Rise Chattanooga, and then, you know, individual artists like J-Flo, Jeremy Lawrence, Cameron C. Grimey, who's leading a lot of the protests right now. Just so many different people through just running a venue in Chattanooga. It's kind of wild how it's come from different angles like that.
A lot of what you tell in this episode of the podcast is a history lesson. Not only the history that a lot of us thought we knew from a different angle, but a lot of history that was not conveyed to a lot of us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, including me. You know, I wasn't taught these things growing up. I mean, I grew up in a hometown. You know, my hometown was 2 hours from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I never heard about the Tulsa race riots until I was, I think, 25 years old, maybe 30. I didn't even hear it in college, and I was a history major in college. It's probably why I love this stuff so much, looking at the historical examples. And I should give the caveat, this is a 20-minute episode. You know, this is like a, I think I say it in the podcast, it's like a tip of an iceberg sort of episode. But yeah, I do think that from my experience of having this conversation specifically with white people to try and describe systemic racism and injustice or structural racism, kind of however you want to phrase it, if you don't understand the history of this, like you don't understand the current moment and how we got to this moment, you cannot understand why people are burning a Target or spending nights in a row out on the streets protesting this. You can't understand why this is a tipping point for so many of our African-American brothers and sisters across the country, as well as others.
Part of what you share is reframing, as I was saying just a moment ago, what we thought we knew, including what happened in the 1960s and the aftermath of what happened in the 1960s.
Yeah. Like I said, I've read a lot, and I think there's a burden in learning these kind of things, and it takes a lot of time. You know, fortunately, like I said, I think I started that journey maybe 4 years ago, and so finding different resources. In the podcast, I mentioned how we look at the Civil Rights Act of the 60s as this massive celebration of progress, and the integration of our schools, this is a great thing. But it was really Malcolm Gladwell's podcast that kind of opened my eyes to that piece. It wasn't anything I read in a book. You know, Malcolm Gladwell did a whole episode on how the end results of integrating our schools resulted in the job loss of like 70% of our African-American teachers. And it completely changed our school system for 50 years in a way that wasn't necessarily positive.
Another author, another thinker plays a role in your podcast, and that's Ibram X. Kendi, whom people have seen quite a bit of on the national stage lately because of his recent work and him appearing on television.
And I can't recommend Stamp from the Beginning enough. It's free on Spotify right now for people to go listen to. I mean, it's a massive, massive work because it is a history of racist ideas going all the way back to the Portuguese getting the first slaves from Africa all the way up to today. What I love about Kendi's book too is he points out, you know, I'm a pastor. The church absolutely has a role in what's happened to African-Americans in our country. But he points out everything did, right? It wasn't just theology at the time. The foundations of science are as rooted in systemic racism as the theology of the white church. And the banking system is as rooted in this problem as anybody else. And so he does a fantastic job in that book of not only just taking you through a history of this, of how we've had progress and then we step back. Progress and then we step back. Like white supremacy finds its way, white privilege finds its way of reasserting itself every single time. That's not just in these big movements. You know, the foundation of so much of what we take for granted as a modern liberal democracy is equally rooted in structural racism that privilege certain people above others.
How, from your experience, have you seen this play out in the Chattanooga area? You are a recent arrival here, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
I'm more recent than you, but I'm curious, taking what you've learned, taking what you've read, taking what you've heard, but also coupling that with what you experience day to day getting out into the community.
I would be incredibly hesitant to say anything that is super contemporary just because I am white, and my experience of CPD, my experience of the structures of our city are obviously very, very, very different than if you grew up in Alton Park or something like that. But I will say the sort of systemic racism that is like that people hear about now and they think, how can people ever believe that or do that, is far more recent in Chattanooga's history than anybody wants to think about, right? So a book that I would recommend to everybody that is 100% local is a book called Constructing the Dynamo of Dixie, Race, Urban Planning, and Cosmopolitanism in Chattanooga by Courtney Knapp. And you can find it on Amazon. She's a professor now. This was essentially her PhD work. But she highlights these examples. And if you look at the 1970s, when we started integrating different city services, even just our park system, at the time, Chattanooga had two segregated parks. They had Warner Park, which was the white park, and they had Lincoln Park, which was the African-American park. And if you look at the history of Lincoln Park in Chattanooga, it's one of the most incredible African-American places in the entire South. Like, there was a baseball field with floodlights. They had an Olympic-sized pool. This was very, very unique. And it became a cultural center for the entire South, was this one African-American park in Chattanooga. Jackie Robinson played in that park. The Negro Baseball League, it was a huge piece of that. And so when integration happened, what that allowed is it allowed essentially, I think at the time, the city council was all white except for one member, I think. And what that allowed city council to do was really just to wring out their hands like, awesome, now we don't have to support Lincoln Park. And they shut down Lincoln Park. They defunded Lincoln Park and moved all those funds to the white Warner Park, which was now integrated. We lost this incredible historical resource and landmark of the African-American community, not just in Chattanooga, but in the entire South, because of something that was supposed to be progress, but because of the way, the sinister way that white privilege works, we actually lost an incredible cultural resource in the name of progress and integration. That's kind of like a way I try and show people that the way that white privilege and systemic and structural racism kind of works even here on a local level. Off the top of my head, I know if you study the city in the 1980s, our mayoral system was elected by the city councilors, and our city council was essentially gerrymandered in such a way that you only had at maximum two African-American city council members. So it was impossible to ever have an African-American mayor in Chattanooga, which we still haven't had, but at least now we have a popular election system that was kind of forced upon our city because our city in the 1980s refused to change.
Another example of what's billed as progress, but also brings these consequences that you talk about, are roadways.
And I get into this in the podcast. The post-World War II period, I don't know that our country will ever experience the amount of wealth creation that happened ever again. And the ways that we squandered that wealth is just fascinating. In almost every American city, poor and black neighborhoods were targeted for urban renewal projects. The housing in those neighborhoods might have been substandard, but what it effectively did was crush the actual community that existed in those places. And so in Chattanooga, we have very real examples of this. I mean, this comes up several times on the Camp House podcast. If you go back in the archives when we talk about urban planning, but Highway 27, especially the way it cut our downtown in half to completely segregate the west side from downtown. They're actually working to change this now and it's getting better. But like if you had tried to walk from the west side when the housing projects were built in the 1950s and 60s, to downtown, it was so hard. There was basically two ways to do it. One was MLK, which was a massive road, or there, I think there's one undercut near the convention center that wasn't really intended for a pedestrian walk at all. You can interpret it incredibly negatively and say there was an intentional effort to keep the west side out of downtown. And even today, you know, the area we refer to as south side is not the south side of our city. You know, the real south side of our city is below I-24. But because of these barriers that we've created, it really does hem out some of our African-American and poor neighborhoods from the downtown core. And our roads have been very, very effective barriers to people engaging with the core of our city.
That's true not only here, but in every major city across the country, including some of the ones where I have lived, and that would include New York City and, yes, Minneapolis.
Yeah.
How do you see this moment?
What I think is fascinating about this moment, it's just a really interesting conversation, because if you go back 3 or 4 years ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates now has been a pretty big leader, national leader within the African-American community and the broader community when it comes to this conversation. But 3 or 4 years ago, the conversation was around reparations, right? Like figuring out some form of reparations for what our country has done to the African-American community and the way we've systematically sort of robbed that community of wealth for so many years. But right now, that conversation hasn't happened. And the conversation right now is entirely about defunding the police, right? Or divesting from the police. That's a fascinating difference, because I feel like it might be easier to have a conversation around reparations right now. But I think the conversation around divesting from the police is actually a really interesting one. Because when it comes to this example of how do we make progress and ensure that there's not a backlash the way that we see continually happen. So if the goal of this movement right now is to divest from the police in order to invest in Black and brown communities, that is the standard that we have to make sure actually happens from this point forward. Because I think a backlash that could happen is, yes, we divest from the police, but where do those resources actually end up going? Are they actually going to go to invest in our Black and brown communities? I have no idea. Who knows if we'll actually get to that point? Whatever action we take, if we don't have a system of accountability on the back end to make sure that the stated goals actually happen, we could be in big trouble. I don't know this for sure, but like you can go back to the 60s and 70s, and I'm guessing we didn't have systems of accountability in place to make sure of how integration was actually impacting Black and brown communities at that time. We just thought, hey, we did it. Pat ourselves on the back, let's move on. As a white person, what I think we understand now is that that's not always the case, that like there's hard work. You know, I have a friend in a recovery program who knows the day that they get out of their treatment, the hard work really, really begins. And I think the same exact thing is true for us in this moment of whatever it is, you know? So if it is the process of reforming or divesting from our police force, there's so much work to do beyond that. The whole point of that episode too is like, it's not just the police force. Like, I think that is an important moment for us to focus on, and we don't need to look away from that. But, you know, let's do something about payday lenders in Chattanooga. Love of God, it's such a horrible thing, the way that's taken advantage of our society. Let's make sure that our medical system is taking care of people in a way that doesn't show racial bias. Another resource that I don't mention in there is Racial Equity Institute has something called the Groundwater Study that shows how this topic of systemic and structural racism is equal across sectors, right? It's not just the police and justice system. It's equally there in education. It's equally there in the medical profession. Equally there in economics and home loans, even today, even beyond redlining. And so I think we have a ton of work to do, but I think having standards of accountability are going to be huge, whether that's with the police force or whether that's in other systems.
Where can people find the podcast, and where can people go online to follow all that you do at the Camp House?
The podcast can be found on iTunes, anywhere. You know, you can find that episode on our Camp House Facebook page right now. I will say the Camp House is in a huge amount of transition right now. We're in the process of purchasing and owning a new building and moving into it when COVID happened. And so we're kind of in the bit of a lurch. Like, I'm not even sure what our website is right now, if that's even up and accurate because of so many changes that have happened. So we're kind of in a bit of a holding pattern when it comes to the Camp House. But if you like our Facebook page, you can stay up to date with stuff there. And yeah, you can find the podcast on iTunes or wherever, hopefully wherever you get your podcast from.
All right, Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chattanooga Theater Center is looking forward in more ways than one while affected by and adjusting to life under COVID-19. Mitch Collins is board president of CTC.
Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I am excited to be here. Thanks for having me, Ray.
You had some news recently about your new executive director.
After a long, probably 4 months nationwide search, we found him right here at home in Chattanooga, Rodney Van Valkenburg. Rodney started his career at the Theater Center after he finished up his master's degrees. He spent 18 years at the Theater Center, spent another probably 20 years at Arts Build. He had a chance to do some leading over at Arts Build, really enjoyed that executive position as he acted as the interim while they were looking for James McKissick. Once that position opened up at the Theater Center, it was kind of a natural move for him to want to take on that role.
And we've spoken to him more than once here on Scenic Roots, and we look forward to speaking to him again in his new old role or his old new role down the road. And speaking of down the road, let's talk about where productions stand now with Theater Center. There was an effort to try to do some productions this month, but then, as is often the case for so many things in this time, there was a change of plan and then another change of plan.
Yes. When we originally, this all started back in March, and we started looking at timelines and all the different things, all the different curves, we anticipated that we might possibly be able to reopen with some very limited capacity in June. And that was the goal. We already had the sets produced for The Hollow and Barefoot in the Park. And so we thought, hey, we can probably still squeeze these in. Unfortunately, that is just not possible with the social distancing and the things that we would need to do, not so much for the people who would come to see the show, but really for our volunteer actors. We just couldn't find a way to really put the shows on and protect them. And so just for safety concerns, we decided to go a little different route. We're pushing those off into the fall. We're still going to try to do those shows. Jury is still out on some of that as we're still making those decisions at this point. But we are going to try to do some partnerships with some different performers and arts organizations in town to utilize the facility, because we can safely put on a show, but we just don't want to put the expense into producing a show. So we're thinking, how can we utilize our facility by partnering up with some other people in town? Once again, we're still in the planning stages of that. We'll see what happens.
You may still be in the planning stages for that, but you have had many, many conversations about whenever you come back on stage in whatever form, what is that going to look like?
It will look very different for the foreseeable future. So what we're going to be looking at is when we do have people in the building, that will be very different. I mean, we're talking mask, hand sanitizing stations, social distancing, the way we pick up tickets or sell tickets, or the way we bring people in and out of the building will be completely different. We'll be utilizing different sets of doors so we can have some one-way traffic. Shows that typically will not have an intermission, so we don't have to have people getting up and down to go to the bathroom. Specific ways of entering the theaters so that when we do get in there and we have those social distance as well, because we'll be at probably a 35 to 40% capacity on those. So we'll have some very specific arrangements for the seats. So yeah, it's going to look very different. Talk about the people on stage. If we're doing a staged reading, everybody will be social distanced. If we're doing, say, a musician, then that's totally different. We have to have 15 feet between musicians. So we're looking into all those criteria now, because it will be. It's going to be very different, but we're looking forward to providing some live entertainment and some live theatrical experiences for people. And we're hoping that people will come see what we're doing.
With shutting down as you had to do, that meant a lot of people lost gigs, lost income.
We were fortunate. We were able to secure a Paycheck Protection Program loan. And so that helped us. We did furlough for just a couple of weeks while we were in the moving things around. We were able to bring everybody back based on that and are still in the process of utilizing some of those funds. Rodney's come on board, not officially. He had some ideas that he's expressed. The staff had some ideas. And so we're trying to basically do this in such a way where we don't have to furlough again, because we don't want to. We want to keep our staff there. They're creative. They're always thinking of new ideas and things that we can do. And if they're not there, then we don't have those things happening. Our goal is to keep them employed, then also, hopefully, then provide that outlet for artists in our community who need an outlet, who need a place to perform and make their own money. Because think about all the individual artists who are out there who don't have an income right now. If we can partner up with those people, everybody wins.
Looking ahead to the fall, once you get past The Hollow and Barefoot in the Park in whatever form, what are you planning to put on stage in these very different conditions?
Our goal is to still provide the season that we announced. The timing may be a little different, but The Sound of Music, if singers are truly super spreaders, it's going to be very difficult for us to do The Sound of Music safely. So at least at this point. Now, once there's a vaccine in place and once we have some other things that we can do, we can get creative with that show and still do the show. We still want to do those shows like The Sound of Music and like Little Women the Musical, but we may have to either delay those, change the order. There's some things that we're going to have to maneuver to make that happen. Once Rodney gets in place, he officially takes over on August 1st. I'm sure that we're going to have some more information by then on exactly what that looks like. At least I hope we do.
And in the meantime, if people want to keep up to date online, where can they go?
They can go to theatercenter.com, and that's theater with an R-E on the end and center with an R-E on the end instead of E-R. And also, they can check out our Facebook page. We're updating that daily, so lots going on.
All right, Mitch, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ray.
On Thursday, restaurants here in Chattanooga will partner with Sempa Community Care to support the fight against HIV here in the Tennessee Valley with the annual Dining Out for Life. Mitzi Ward is Development and Events Coordinator at Sempa.
Mitzi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
This is a different Dining Out for Life than what we usually see.
Just like Strides of March, you kind of bend and do things. You've got to definitely thinking out of the box. That's kind of what we're doing this go round. Just like we did with Strides of March back at the end of March, with Dining Out for Life this year, of course, our biggest focus is going to be the restaurants themselves. So many of us, I mean, you can ask any of the nonprofits around here. And for years, our local eateries, our local restaurants have stepped up for us. Not just Sempa Community Care, not just the Chattanooga Cares Foundation, but all the nonprofits around town. So this year, we're really trying to get people out to fill the restaurants to capacity, to whatever, maybe that's 50% capacity, 30%, whatever they are comfortable with. We want to get the people out, and we also want them to get takeout orders. Order up, do a takeout meal. Don't cook that night. Nobody wants to cook. You're sick of your own cooking. Call one of your favorite restaurants who's participating in Dining Out for Life, and let's work together and help them, which in turn helps us. It's just trying to get back out there, trying to get us back as close to our new normal as we can.
And as much as this is about focusing on the restaurants this time, above and beyond that, this is focusing on the mission. Tell us more about that.
Chattanooga Cares Foundation and Sempa Community Care have been here for over 30 years helping people in our community with HIV who are HIV positive, whether they are infected or affected by HIV. Chattanooga Cares and now Sempa Community Care has been there for them. We want to continue that mission, and Dining Out for Life helps us do that. The funds that are raised through Dining Out for Life come back to Sempa Community Care and actually go directly to our clients, to our patients.
What are some of the things that you folks at Sempa have been hearing from clients at this time? Of course, so many people had to stay home, and now there's reopening in various stages.
We have been open the entire time. We went down to a very small crew, and we did a lot of telehealth. But just like with all the rephasing going on, we're rephasing. More clients are coming in. Our doors, of course, the doors never were closed. We've been open the entire time. We're just expanding our hours back to our regular hours before the pandemic.
And then as far as partnering with all of these restaurants, what are some of the unique challenges that you all are having to face this time around in order to stage this event this time?
Well, of course, everything's going to be the masks and going to be focusing on patio seating. So, and then, of course, the staying 6 feet apart, the smaller parties. So where we used to try to pack a restaurant, like I said, we would love to get it at capacity, which, like I said, may be 30%, maybe 50%, whatever that is. If you feel comfortable coming out, we'd love for you to come out. If you don't, do takeout. Nobody wants to cook. I am so sick of my own cooking. I cannot tell you how sick I am of my own cooking. So it's the opportunity for people to take a night off and give back. So yes, there will be social distancing. There will be as much patio seating as we can. And then once you get inside the restaurants, it's definitely going to be at social distancing. And they will limit the number at your table.
Where can people go online for more information about all this?
For more information, they can go to sempa.org. That's C-E-M-P-A.org. And you'll be able to check out the restaurants that are participating. We've got so many great restaurants.
All right, Mitzi. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. Good afternoon. I'm Richard Winham. This afternoon, we have a wonderful session from two of my favorite musicians, Jennifer Daniels and Jeff Neal, recorded for the WoodSongs streaming show on the Deo Clinic website on their Facebook page every Friday afternoon at 12 noon. This is Jennifer Daniels and Jeff Neal.
So how have you been doing? You faring well through all this quarantine stuff? We've been okay. We've gotten to write a lot. We haven't gotten to play much, at least outside of our living room. But we've gotten to write a whole lot, which is cool. So looking forward to recording. Let's see. How about All I Want? Will you play that one with me? I like it. He said, could you hear him? He said, I could do whatever I want. Yeah.
She could have stopped you, but she let you go. Oh no, oh no, oh no. You want the kind of things that light up the sky, but all I want is you. You wanna tie the tails together on fire, but all I want is you. There's an anger you cherish and hide, you cuddle sweetly. Along with your pride, you could have starved that, but you fed it all day back before it was too late. You want the kind of things that light up the sky, but all I want is you. You wanna tie the tails together on fire, but all I want is you. Look at me now, I swear you miss me every time. I could wear those flashy things and get real loud, but you'll waste your strength in the plight. And all that's best in our life, you'll miss the hope that is quiet.
Hair was an active participant in that song. That sometimes happens. I haven't had it cut, and it's not so much because we've been sequestered. I haven't had it cut since October. Periodically, I will just have, I'll be like, I'm just so sick of it, just go. And they're like, oh, it's so short now. And then I just don't go back for a long time. So I wrote a song about my hair. No, I didn't.
Anchored by the hope you take for others, become your chance to bear this storm. Even if the aching won't get better, oh, then at least you can stay. Dark and violent, and you have gotten all boxed up in fear. Renting room, loneliness and silence. Oh, you could just stay right.
It's sort of mean. It's not at you. It's, I don't think it's at any of you.
What kind of rage is this? It throws itself out against the window pane. What kind of rage this? It keeps me guessing, keeps me running, and does enslave. What kind of rage? What kind of fool am I? Tell me again, I did not understand the first 11 times. Rage is this, cloaks itself up and wanders out as fear. What kind of rage this? It kisses cheeks, lips. pushes this, it throws itself on the window pane. What kind of rage steals an end? What kind of fool am I? What kind of fool am I? What kind of fool to let you do? Again. No.
I will play you a nice song. I'm going to play you a love song, and it's very sweet. It started out, this towel was on the ground in my living room. I'm not sure why. We do have two 11-year-old children, human children, as well as animals. Hopefully it's just so I could blot. So I was in, I think we were on tour in Florida. And this woman told me, she had watched the whole show, like 2 hours worth of a show. And she said to me, I have to take my final, my test, for palm reading. And I need practice. So would it be okay if I read your palms? I'm just, yes, yes, you may. I absolutely. And also, I just sort of assumed it was something you had to be like gifted at. But no, there's classes and you can take them. I wish I had connected with her better and had found out about her success in her exam. Anyway, she read my palms, and you know, she's watched me sing. And she says, I see that you are very passionate and you're intense. Like, I am, you're right. You're really good at this. She's like, I see that you have a cataclysmic relationship with your mom. And I'm like, I wanted to like encourage her, but my mom and I have a pretty good, I was like, no, it was pretty good, you know. She's like, your sister. I'm like, I don't have a sister. And she's, you know, until she got it right. And I'm like, yes, that is where the problem is. And so, and that, for some reason, that little vignette kind of haunted me for a while and came out in this song, which has nothing to do with the woman, but, well, you'll see. Palms up, and I will read the lines. I don't have gifts with which to decipher, but it could still feel fine. You could call me sweetheart, I already call you mine. You could show me how you would hold me if you could read my mind. All these days could make up our life and all of our hair turn gray. I love you every single day. Show me pictures you painted back at school, and I pull out those songs that I wrote that nobody thought were cool. You decide to love me, I'd really like to know. Stage the rest of our days just to tell each other so. Then let those days make up our life, let both of our faces change. I love you every single day. Thank you. finish and how to hold a kid. And you could show me how to stay married just like your daddy did. I will learn to serve you and I'll learn not to close my heart. You'll convince me that I'm still pretty beside the man you are. All these days will make up our life and all of our strength give way. I love you every single day. delicious. Should we do one more? Mm-hmm. I think we went past time. But I don't think it infringed upon anyone else. Thanks for letting us play for you. We appreciate you listening to us. We hope that you'll consider donating to the DEO Clinic in Dalton. It's deoclinic.org if you're interested in going there. I'm Jennifer Daniels. This is Jeff Neal. All right, let's play this last one and let these people go get lunch. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a good day to live.
Always so good to hear them. Jennifer Daniels and Jeff Neal, a show streamed on the DEO Clinic Facebook page from Woodsongs in Dalton this past Friday here on Scenic Roots.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nurabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.